Okay, good afternoon. My name is Joe Yost. If most of you know that, that's why you're... I mean, you wouldn't be here if you didn't know what this was about. I'm just going to give a little seminar on what I call D-Day in depth. It's, as you know, I'm working on a game for Decision for the reprint of Atlantic Wall, which is the original big monster game that they did, covering from June 6th to about July 1st. And we're reprinting that game. Of course, I've had to do a lot of research for that and whatnot. So the way I'm going to organize this is talk about the events leading up to June 6th, and then cover the D-Day itself, the various beaches and what happened, and some of the things that were developed along that. And then after that, I can talk about the game, what's going to be in the game, and how the game is going to work, and some ideas behind that. So that's, I guess, what it's all about. Okay, so D-Day. As early as 1940, as soon as they had retreated off of the beaches of Dunkirk, Churchill and everybody else was already thinking, you know, one day we're going to have to come back, we're going to have to get back to the continent. Because, you know, the whole idea was they're going to beat Germany. And the only way to do that was eventually to reinvade, get a ground force onto the continent, and drive, obviously, to Berlin or whatever, or do whatever it took to destroy the German army. So the planning goes way back for this. Initially, there were a whole bunch of little plans that the British were cooking up to accomplish this. So the first thought was, well, we'll go in through Norway. And that was called Ajax. And even in 1941, they were thinking of possibly, you know, getting troops in and opening up the front in Norway. Another thing was called, Tinder, which was in the event of a German government collapse, and this was 1942, they were making plans, and these were all just rough idea plans. This wasn't any detailed kind of planning. This is where people would get together and talk about, well, what might we do? There were plans in case Germany collapsed from within that we might have to get back into the continent real quick there, because, you know, obviously that would present itself as a big opportunity.
Why did they believe that the government might collapse? Was there a reason for that?
I think it's because as early as 1938, there were people already plotting to overthrow Hitler. And some of these people were in contact loosely with, and there were allied agents of the West in Germany, and some of these people would you know, go through Switzerland and Sweden to try to contact these people and say, well, we have your support. So the Allies knew that there was a movement within Germany itself, however weak or however, you know, tenuous, to overthrow Hitler. So they knew that, you know, there's always that possibility. And
that's the SBI game.
Gotcha.
Plot to assassinate. Right. There was a plan, it was never really given a code name, there was a plan to actually get throw some people onto the continent in 42 in case the Soviets collapsed. They were really worried that if, you know, Russia was going to get knocked out of the war, then it would almost become unwinnable from that point on. So there was a plan to get some guys onto the Khotan Peninsula. And they were almost viewed as sacrificial. They figured that even if they all, you know, if we have to re-evacuate them, that would create just enough diversion to take some pressure off the Soviet Union in the summer of 42 so that they wouldn't collapse. So there was, you know, there were a lot of wild ideas about getting it back on the continent. The first real one, where the U.S. and the British start actually talking is Sledgehammer. And Marshall, who was, of course, the U.S. chief of staff, wanted to do this. The Americans were really very keen to invade and get back on as quickly as they were. They're probably it was a very unrealistic viewpoint, you know, but they just thought it was kind of like the can-do attitude. We'll just get on the continent and, you know, and beat these guys. So Marshall wanted to do a full-fledged invasion in 42, and Churchill and the British chiefs of staff just said, well, you know, that's insane. We don't have anywhere near the kind of combat power or experience that we need. And the other biggest thing that they saw is we did have the training, we don't have the shipping. And the big constraint for an amphibious invasion of the continent was going to be LSTs, the landing ship tank. They were already using, these were just starting to come off the assembly line, but they only had 50 at that time, 1942. And just to give you an idea, by the time D-Day, the actual D-Day rolls around, there were something like, I believe there were like 700 or 800 LSTs used in the actual invasion. So that's how far they were from the kind of capacity they would actually end up using. So mid-42 to late 42, early 43, you know, there was talk of doing sledgehammer, but that was nixed by the British. And the British actually convinced the Americans to go ahead and do gymnast, which was the Allied invasion of North Africa, because they figured by the time a late 42 rolls on, we'll have enough shipping to be able to actually do something in the Mediterranean. It'll take some pressure off the Eastern Front, and you know that'll be more realistic. But even when 43 rolls around, by the middle of 43, the Americans still want to do an invasion. They want to go in and open up the Second Front in 1943, and that was called Roundup. And that was supposed to put about a force of about 20 divisions onto the continent in the summer of 43. But once there again, the problems were shipping, where they wanted to pull experienced divisions out to do the assault, but those divisions were actually already involved in the Mediterranean. The 1st Infantry Division, there was talk of the 3rd Infantry, the 9th Infantry. Well, those guys were all in North Africa and Sicily, and they hadn't really finished Sicily yet, and they didn't even have a toehold on Italy, so that kind of put a big crimp in that plan. There was a plan to invade Norway again in 1943, and that was called Jupiter. But just by that time, the Germans had I can't remember the number of divisions the Germans had in Norway, but it was actually pretty considerable. I think they had something like 6 or 7 divisions in Normandy, and there were no beaches, and you know they would have had to head to port. And going back to ports, the one thing that's really important in terms of the whole D-Day planning is, as you guys know, the British did an assault against Dieppe in 1942, and they used the 2nd Canadian Infantry Division to do this. And this was kind of let's just see what happens. They never meant to take it and hold it. It was just to see if it was like a big raid. They were raiding the coast of France and Belgium and Norway ever since 1941. They dropping commandos and things like that. And those were like pinpricks, and that was just to, keep the Germans occupied and kind of develop doctrine as to, how do we land troops, a force on an enemy held territory. So the big raid was Dieppe. And, of course, you guys pretty much, I think most of you know that was, it went pretty badly. There were a lot of mistakes made. Planning was horrible. It wasn't well planned. And the big lessons from that were don't assault a port city. That was the first big lesson. The Allies knew that eventually they'd have to have ports, and someone said, "Well, let's just take a port city." So the big first lesson was we can't assault a port city. They're too well fortified. The Germans fortified the ports very quickly and very well, and of course the Germans fortified them even further after Dieppe. The other problem was with the beaches. Most of the beaches along the channel had what's called a shingle, and those are those little pebbles and stuff. And those are really hard for tanks and vehicles to get across. And if you have a seawall, that makes it even that much more difficult. And a lot of the British got some armor, Churchill's and I think Matilda's, on the beach at Dieppe, but they couldn't get off the beach. They couldn't get inland to support any troops that might have made a breakthrough. So that was another big lesson. And from that lesson, the British Armor Corps, what's his name? I can't remember. Percy Hobart develops the 79th Armored Division, which is just a specialized division that will be used to breach obstacles, cross ditches, clear landmines. So he basically comes up with a flail tank. They come up with the bridging tanks. They come up with the flamethrower, the crocodiles. There's like 5 or 6 different variations of armored assault tanks. And a lot of these are staffed by basically the Royal Engineers, and even the Royal Marines had a contingent of Royal Marine Assault Engineers, and those guys were the guys in the what they call them They were in the Churchills that had that fired a satchel charge. The Centaur was the code name for that tank, and that was a bunker buster tank. It had a 95 millimeter spigot round that actually would shoot a demolition charge 100 yards to a bunker, and basically be able to knock out if the bunker wasn't like some super bunker, but just an ordinary bunker could usually knock them out. So that was the second lesson. The third lesson was there wasn't proper bombardment preparation. They really needed to bombard a fortified area for at least, any bombardment was like only about 30 minutes, if that. They thought surprise could actually take the position. And it turned out they needed anywhere from 3 to 4 hours of proper bombardment if they're going to hit something that heavily fortified. Another lesson was, you have to have air supremacy before you do this. They thought they could invade the place and then throw an air, put air cover over while this was in place. And the RAF basically wasn't able to support anybody on the ground because it was just too busy fighting off German fighters and trying to keep the fighters away from the landing force. So there was no air support for anybody that was on the beach. Plus, there was no way to communicate with them because there was no air ground system to do that. And then the last one was just all about command control. They didn't have dedicated invasion command control ships, and that's another thing they realized is, look, each sector, every beach that we land on, has to have its own dedicated command control ship, where the divisional commander is on that ship, he can communicate with bombarding forces, he can communicate with units ashore, and all that other stuff. So that all happened in 42, and all this really applies to what happens in D-Day, because those were some of the key lessons learned. All right, so going back to 43, we talked about Roundup and the fact that, there wasn't going to be an invasion in 1943 of the Congo either, even though everybody wanted to. But in the summer of 43, they started actual planning of whatever is going to be used to invade the Congo again. And this was done in the office of the Chief of Staff to the Supreme Allied Commander, and that's what COSAC stood for. And COSAC came up with the initial plans. And the problem with COSAC is, at this stage, it didn't really have an overall commander yet. It was just a planning staff put together. Nobody knew who was going to command anything yet. So these guys were just still coming with ideas. And the first plan was, they looked at the beaches, and they looked, okay, looking at the Dutch coast, there was no way they could get air cover there. The beaches were also, and there's the problem of inundation if you invade in Holland. It would be very easy to stymie any kind of advance off, inland. The Belgian beaches were considered to be too exposed and had limited capacity. By exposed, as they knew the channel weather can be really iffy. So the beaches had to have some kind of protection so that there could be proper offloading and cover from the elements. The pad at Calais was just too strong. Like, the Germans had too many forces there, and it was the beaches there were also exposed. And the other problem with the pad at Calais is a lot of the beaches, just like at Dieppe, have enormous cliffs. Basically bordering them, so that would be another big problem. So pretty early on, it was decided that the Pas de Calais would be used as a feint. I mean, they probably wouldn't invade there, but they would through the use of double agents and how they positioned the landing forces, they would try to create enough doubt in the Germans' minds that they couldn't move units from there to other locations. And as far as this deployment of Allied units for D-Day, another thing in 1943 they realized, 42 actually, they realized, is that all the ports in southern England would have to be refurbished because they just didn't have the kind of capacity they envisioned, because eventually they knew they'd have to have at least 1.5 million soldiers ashore by D plus 90. And all these guys had to come from England. So another thing that started happening in 42 is all the ports, Portsmouth, Southampton, all those places start getting upgraded, and they started restricting access to them and everything else. And by carefully, there were certain things they would let the Germans know, and this goes back to this Operation Bodyguard, which was, we want the Germans to know just enough to make the wrong decisions. And by just enough is, you know, letting them know where Patton was, you know, and creating this phantom army group, which Patton was supposed to be the leader of. Because the Germans, you pretty much may have seen this in the movies, and you probably read about this, the Germans feared Patton. They just figured, look, this is their one commander who understands Blitzkrieg, and he's got to be the guy leading the invasion. Because, I mean, you know, they laughed at Montgomery. They just figured Montgomery's too cautious. You know, wherever he lands, it's okay, we can deal with him. So the Allies knew this, so they basically used Patton as a feint, you know, put him in control of an army group. That was that whole thing where they put into the dummy tanks and the dummy landing craft and all that. They arrayed it so it looked like most of that force was ready to go against the Pas-de-Calais. And so that's what the Germans, for a, and one of the big problems with intelligence is you have to be careful that you have to understand enemy capabilities and intentions and everything. But the Germans read too much of their own thought processes into where they would invade. And because they would have probably, you know, they would just, the German mindset was to go right straight into the teeth of the fiercest opposition and crack it really quickly. And it, by the way, as a sidebar, this is a really good, I kind of think this is my own theory, that had the United States Marine Corps been operating in the ETO, and let's say had a Marine general, or had this been left to strictly Navy planning and the Marines, they probably would have tried to invade a port city. Because the Navy doctrine was not, you know, they didn't want to have ships waiting offshore off of beaches. That was the whole point of the Marine Corps was, you know, clear the islands quickly, set up your infrastructure, because we don't want the Navy hanging around supporting an amphibious fleet, because it makes it vulnerable. Even though the Germans didn't have anywhere near the kind of naval power that the Japanese did, that's just a Navy mindset. So I tend to think that had the Marine Corps been in Europe, they probably would have tried to direct assault of a city, of a port, with the concomitant assaults on either side of it. So anyway, going back to what we were talking about. So the Pas-de-Calais is a thing. The River Seine from Le Havre down to Caen is about, it has the same problems as the Pas-de-Calais. It's really strong, it's well covered, and the terrain behind it actually is pretty rough. That's another reason why in a lot of Normandy games, you see there's that flank along the sea that where the 6th Airborne drops, and everyone always wonders, well, why didn't they just drive up along that coast, because they would have naval gunfire support. Well, the terrain behind that is actually pretty rugged. From that, from Caen to about the River Seine, it's really cut up. There's a lot of fort or woods and things like that. Plus, there's also the big naval coastal guns that were protecting the port of Le Havre. So they get to Normandy, and Normandy has pretty much, actually Normandy's perfect when you look at everything combined. And it's kind of funny that no one realizes it had sheltered beaches. The beaches were very big. They could accommodate a large offloading capacity. One of the biggest important things is that Normandy could be reached by Allied air cover. Whereas certain areas can't. So their defenses weren't strong in Normandy in late 43, early 44 yet. They were considerable but not really strong. The one, I guess, con against it was that there was no real suitable port really close by the beaches. I mean, the nearest port would have been Cherbourg, and as you know, that took weeks to get to. So, and Brittany and Biscay and the Bay of Biscay were out because those were beyond air cover. So you basically the Cossack plan is, again, everyone realizes by the end of 43, it's going to be Normandy. And that's actually, it's really interesting that they were able to keep that secret up until the day they invaded. The Germans never, I mean, there was, you know, Hitler had his intuition and all this other stuff. And some, you know, if you looked at it and thought about it, you'd say, yeah, Normandy makes sense. But given all the planning that was done, the Germans never actually found out. They never got confirmation that it was going to be Normandy. So they were always in the dark. And that was important because they kept the 15th Army stuck in the Pas-de-Calais for the better part of a month and a half. There were still 12 to 14 divisions by the middle of July, still waiting for an invasion to come. Even though there were generals in Normandy by this time, were saying they're not going to invade anywhere else. I mean, you know, we need those soldiers here. But there was still enough fear in the higher upper echelons of German command that they kept these divisions, the 15th Army, stuck there. Okay, so that's, you know, that's what's happening in the planning up until about January 44. So then the next important thing is who's going to command this thing. George Marshall wanted to be the commander. He wanted to be have the Eisenhower role for the invasion. FDR actually kind of thought that wasn't a bad idea. But FDR's advisor said that Marshall was more valuable in Washington and on the home front than he would be leading the invasion. So he loses out. Given that the predominant force by the time the campaign is really going is going to be U.S., you know, they decided it has to be an American ground commander. And so they chose Eisenhower because he basically got along with everybody. He was the one guy who understood, you know, the politics of coalition warfare. So Eisenhower basically becomes the chief, supreme Allied commander. As a sop to the Commonwealth forces, they make Montgomery the overall ground force commander of 12th Army Group once it lands in Normandy. Trafford Leigh Mallory is made the air commander, and originally there was another guy who was supposed to command the naval component, but he wasn't deemed experienced enough, so they changed at the last minute and took Admiral Bertrand Ramsay to lead the naval component of Overlord. And it's kind of sad, he dies in 1945, I think in an airplane crash, so just a little thing there. So Monty's the overall ground commander. He comes from the Mediterranean, and he looks at the Cossack plan on January 3rd, and Eisenhower had seen the draft of this plan, the original, which was originally three divisions, a U.S., a Canadian, and a British division, landing between Caen and where Omaha Beach is, not quite all the way over to Omaha, with an airborne division on either side. So originally it was going to be five divisions initially, with three follow-up divisions that evening and in the next morning. So you figure they'd have eight divisions ashore by noon of D plus one. Eisenhower thought that was too weak, but he didn't really say a lot yet because he wasn't the actual guy who was going to have to be landing. So he kind of didn't comment on that too much. But when Monty saw it, he tore into the whole staff. He looked at the plan on January 3rd and said, This is crap. You know, this isn't going to work at all. We don't have anywhere near the number of forces or the area that we're going to need to make a big enough lodgment to hold against German counterattacks. So 4 days later, he comes back with his own plan, and at that point, it's what we kind of see as what happened. He extends the beaches over to where Utah Beach is, so that he's landing on the Catawba Peninsula, because he knows he wants to cut that off, and they have to take Cherbourg. He expands it from three divisions landing initially to about five, plus another additional airborne division, so that there's three airborne divisions. So you go from five divisions initially to basically nine, when you figure that the guys that landed in Omaha were almost like two divisions, to nine divisions. By the way, Marshall wanted to land four airborne divisions after he saw the Cossack plan. He originally wanted to come in with a whole Allied airborne army. He wanted to put because the British still had the 1st Airborne Division, which just sits in England historically until Market Garden. And Marshall thought that they should land the Brits not just where the Pegasus Bridge was, but also around Caen. He wanted to put an airborne division surrounding Caen, which would be interesting. You know, when we gain that it would be interesting to see how that actually plays out. You know, plus the two divisions. So there would have been two divisions on either side. So Montgomery comes back with this plan, and it's pretty much what we see going in for D-Day. And at this point, from January to June, the first thing Allies are concerned about are the transportation system. You know, they want to destroy that as much as possible so the Germans can't reinforce. Because that was the other biggest problem was the key to having a safe lodgment is that we have to be able to reinforce the battlefront faster than the Germans. And the Germans are going to move everything in pretty much by rail. And we have to bring it over beaches. So they have to destroy the transportation network. And to do that, they have to use bombers, but to do that, they have to destroy German air power. So the bomber command guys, Spatz and Harris and all, they actually still think they can win the war by just bombing German cities. You know, they're still convinced, look, we can bring the Germans to the knees if you just let us bomb the crap out of them. But at this point, you know, Churchill and Roosevelt and Marshall and all these bring their combined power to bear on these guys and say, look, you have to support the invasion. I mean, regardless of what you think, we have to get ground forces and they have to be able to survive. So they're forced to play along. So they look at it and say, okay, first thing we'll do is destroy the German Air Force. So from about February of 44 to about May of 44, they just concentrate on destroying the plants that produce fighters. They start going after oil. And by just throwing so many planes at the Germans, they essentially just wipe out the German Air Force in the West. The German Air Force is made impotent. So number one objective, air supremacy, is accomplished, will be complete by the time you get to June 6th. The bombers and the medium bombers take out the German basically rail transportation system leading to the areas of the invasion. And they have to be careful how they do that because they don't want to give away that it's Normandy. But by carefully choosing the rail junctions they bomb, they actually manage to do it without making it obvious what area they're actually trying to isolate. Because they'll save those last critical bridges that they have to take out for just a few days before D-Day, so they don't give anything away. So that's what happens in the air. They build up a lot of shipping, of course. They finally have all the LSTs and assault ships that they need. So they were originally thinking that they were going to launch invasion on May 31st. But, you know, with weather, as you know how history has gone, the weather was pretty chaotic that whole week of May 31st to the first week of June. So there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of hand-wringing as to, you know, when they're going to really do it. They can't keep the soldiers. They have to, basically they need about 24 hours of lead time to start the mobilization. And once they get the troops on, they can really only hold them on the ships for about 48 hours before, you know, it's like they miss the next tide and the moon's dates and everything else, and they got to get the soldiers off the ships. So on June 4th or 5th, the weather looks really bad. Ike postpones it for 24 hours. Then he gets the forecast from the meteorologists that we're going to have a brief window of opportunity from June 5th to June 6th. And, you know, he makes a momentous decision and says, we're going. He tells staff, we're going to go, because it's kind of like, we can't keep these guys pent up like this. So they make a decision to do the invasion, okay? The first part of it, so now we're at June 6th, okay. Any questions so far, okay, leading up to this point? Anybody curious about anything? Yeah.
Was there any reaction in America against the fact Ike is in charge, he's American.
Right.
But you have three British officers under him,
right.
Ronnie Lee, Mallory, and Ramsey, are all British officers, and they're running everything under him.
Right.
Okay. So was there any negative reaction in the United States to that?
I haven't read anything yet that openly admits to any kind of dissension or grumbling about that. I'm sure there were American officers and stuff who probably weren't totally happy with this. And Montgomery wasn't a very popular person in the U.S. Army by this time because of Sicily and, you know, the whole rivalry between he and Patton and, you know, how he was viewed. That's important from the whole point of that is once the Normandy campaign starts in this game, you really have to have army boundaries in any kind of simulation, I think, is my opinion, to simulate how the campaigning is going on. Because the difference between the two officer corps, the British, you know, the Commonwealth armies, and the U.S. Army, how they operated and their whole approach to warfare was so different that you know, they couldn't have actively, they couldn't have cooperated very well that summer. Now later on, when you get into the fall of 44, they work together a lot better. Like for instance, during the Hurtgen campaign in November, actually even in September and October, a number of U.S. divisions are actually put under British control when they fight up near the Peel Marshes and things like that. And when they launch the November offensive, the U.S. Infantry Division cooperates with the British Division to take a city or something like that. But in Normandy, in the summer of Normandy, that probably couldn't happen. And their whole method of supplying the armies and operating was really different. And that it's interesting, too, because that actually leads to the problem of Omaha Beach, which we can get into later when we actually get to the landings. Sure.
How many of those early plans that... Yeah. They floated out.
Right.
Do you think we're in response to Stalin's demand that he get help for that second front?
I think
because I know he was constantly right. asking for that. At least that's what my reading showed me.
Well, I think a lot of them were. And then it's weird because it's funny because it seems like the Americans were more sensitive to what Stalin needed than what the British needed. I mean, what the British thought. I mean, the British were worried that, you know, they didn't want Russia knocked out of the war for obvious reasons, but they...
And then my follow-up is, okay, so they're working with that one, but were the British also concerned about what happens if we land and have to leave again?
Well, everybody was concerned
about
that.
Well, I understand that, but I think the Brits were really worried about that. That's why they really kept saying, no, you're not ready yet. They wanted to know when they got there, they weren't leaving.
So.
I think they didn't want to have another Dunkirk, essentially having the...
Right.
I don't think the Brits thought the public could handle it.
Right. Well, the other big problem was that, and everyone, and Eisenhower knew this, and the Germans were right, too. I mean, if you defeated if Overloader had been defeated... There probably wouldn't have been another invasion until 45. They just would not have been able to get the resources. Yeah, it would have really strained, and it would have strained the coalition, the partnership between the two. And the British just didn't feel like they didn't have inexhaustible manpower reserves. They'd been fighting, you know, since 39, and losing people all over the place. So by the time 1944 rolls around, they're looking at it and saying, look, this is it. This is our army, and we will not be able to build another one. Because if they had to land in 45, it would have been mostly American divisions. You know, I mean, there were Americans and Canadians with a token British force, because the British just wouldn't have been able to have enough men to contribute. Because as it was, they started disbanding divisions in August. The 59th Division actually gets disbanded so they can be used to replace... of the infantry losses in the other Commonwealth division. So I've roughly covered the planning, and the process. I'll spend a little quick time as far as what the Germans were thinking. Of course, the Germans, you know, knew that the Allies were going to try to invade, they would have to invade again to beat them. And there were two schools of thought as to how to defeat that. There was the Rommel, who basically said, we need to have our panzer divisions near the beaches, because he had fought on the Western Front, and he understood Allied air power. And he just felt that, any type of actual maneuvering in the operational sense, where you had to move divisions more than 10 miles, was just going to be, so hazardous, and they're going because of Allied air power. It's weird. Rundstedt was the overall commander in the West, but you had Rommel under him as a sop to the two schools, and it was kind of also Hitler's way of always making sure he had the upper hand by having commanders below him who were kind of that weren't working on the same page. That way it gave him more power to dictate, you know, how the campaign would actually run. So Rommel said we should have the Panzer divisions near the beaches. Guy von Schweppenberg, who was actually the actual Panzer commander, he becomes Panzer Group Commander West, who was supposed to be the commander of all the operational Panzer Reserve, wants to operate as a classical German Panzer commander. We want to keep them in the rear in reserve, find out where the Allies are striking, and then meet them with a big, massive Panzer counterattack. Anyway, it's almost like the Japanese idea of the decisive battle. You know, whether it's the Japanese in the Pacific are thinking, we'll have this fleet and we'll meet them in one grand battle, and that'll be it. Well, for Schweppenberg, it was like, let's keep the Panzers in reserve, because if we put them near the beach, they're going to be blasted by naval gunpowder, they're going to be attrited very quickly, and we won't have anything left to counterattack. Well, the Germans, Hitler kind of basically lets them, he basically has a foot in each plan. So instead of having one coherent plan, there's no coherency at all. Some of the, you know, the 21st Panzer Division is attached to 7th Army near the beaches, but, you know, a lot of the other Panzer Divisions, 12th SS, Panzer Lehr, all those, are held back the way Schweppenberg wants. And they can only be released by Hitler. Those are part of the big Panzer Reserve. You can't do anything unless Hitler approves it. Other than that, they had the static coast divisions, which were put up right up against the coast and fortifications. They had almost no mobility. All their trucks were taken away from them. Their artillery was put in static emplacements. There were, out of the 55 divisions in the West, I believe about 30 of them were pretty much classified as static or unreliable. You had essentially 8 to 10 Panzer divisions in the West. 2nd SS Panzer Corps, which is 9th and 10th, which are rebuilding, briefly get sent to the Eastern Front in April because the 1st Panzer Army is being pocketed, but they're brought back when the invasion occurs. Then, aside from those divisions, you've got about 12 to 14 other divisions, or Fallschirmjäger, which are classified as attack capable. They have some mobility. You can generally motorize about one third of them at any one time, which is what happens when the Allies invade. A lot of these divisions take a conf group and motorize it and send it to the Normandy front so they can get there right away. As I said earlier, Normandy was originally not strongly defended. It wasn't strongly defended as Pas-de-Calais. But starting in the spring of 44, Hitler had, you know, some kind of a brainstorm or whatever. He had his intuition, so he thought, well, maybe it is going to be Normandy. So he started actually directing more soldiers into the Normandy area. And for instance, the 91st Air Landing Division, which is where it is close to the area where the 82nd eventually ends up landing, wasn't there in the spring, but they get moved to that area. The 352nd, which is the guys that actually contribute to the defense of Omaha, were originally near Somme Lo. They weren't near the beaches, but they're moved up to the beaches about 2 to 3 weeks before they're supposed to invade. And the Americans knew that. A lot of sources you read will tell you there was a surprise that the 352nd was at Omaha, but they actually knew that the division had been moved closer to the beaches. So, you know, that's just somebody covering their rear end after the fact. So Germany's made stronger. Rommel does a couple of tours of the Norman Peninsula, of the Cotentin Peninsula and the Norman coast, and he says, you know, you've got to put in more landmines and stuff. And the big problem for the Germans is their troops they're still training up a lot of their troops, but they're using a lot of these troops to actually build the beach defenses, you know, the swinging gates, the tetrahedrons and all that stuff. So there's this whole problem of, well, we can either have them build all this stuff or we can train them up. And the choice was to, fortify the beaches. So a lot of these guys are just, you know, they're putting in the anti-glider posts, what they call Rommel's asparagus. They're laying wire and all that stuff. They don't actually get a lot of time to train. When you're training an army, you start from the smallest unit. And the German army originally was very fastidious about this. Before they released a division to combat, it was like, okay, you start with they use Zugs and companies and stuff, but I was talking U.S. terms. You know, you start with a squad, platoon, company, train the companies up, then you train up the battalions and so on. So when you're finally done, the divisional commander understands how to maneuver with his regiments. And the same was true with the Panzerdivisions. Well, all these German infantrymen on beaches and divisions were just spending their time constructing. So they weren't well trained, as well trained as they should have been. So that's kind of like a brief outline of the state of the German units in Normandy. So when they invade, you've got the 709th Infantry Division, which covers from Caen up to about, 716th, from Caen to where Omaha is. It's a static division. It's got two Ostfront battalions attached to it. Originally, it only had six battalions. It's a two-regiment division with three battalions in each regiment. And they attached some Ost troop in the 441st and the 7th. I'm sorry, I forgot the number of the other one, but the 441st is near Juneau and Gold Beach. The other one is near where the 6th Airborne lands. And from Omaha to about Isigny, you have the 352nd. And parts of the 352nd and the 716th are coming over Omaha Beach. From Carentan to Cherbourg, you have the 709th with the same thing, two-regiment division, three battalions per regiment with two East Front battalions. You have the 91st Air Landing Division between Saint-Mère-Glis, which is on the Catoctin's land, and Saint-Sever-le-Vicomte. And it's interesting, they were originally going to drop the 82nd Airborne Division further south than where it dropped. They were going to drop it about 7 to 8 miles further west, and that would have been right in the middle of where this new division is. And they probably wouldn't have been able to establish contact with it in the first week had they done that. But they understood that area was heavily reinforced, so they moved the 82nd Airborne drop zones closer to the beaches. So the invasion was on. All right. So the 82nd and the 101st drop, they have fairly scattered airdrops. Only the 505th of the 82nd has a relatively good drop, where most of the battalions or companies are within a mile or two of the drop zone. Everybody else is, you know, they're scattered anywhere from 1 to 6 miles away from their drop zones. The 101st is a little bit better. Their drops are maybe 50% more active than the 82nd. There's actually a blessing to this, and that the drops were so scattered the Germans couldn't figure out what the objectives were and what these guys were doing. It just, to them, was just like there's this huge cloud of paratroopers stretching from Montauburg, which is about 7 or 8 miles northwest of Utah Beach, all the way to where guys were landing south of Carentan. You know, they were scattered, so widely scattered, no German commander could look at the situational points that were starting to come in at 1 o'clock in the morning and say, well, what are they doing? The Brits dropped a little more accurately. Their drops are about 75% more accurate than the American drops. They dropped two airborne brigades, six battalions, and their big objective is the Pegasus Bridge. They actually dropped a company from the Air Landing Brigade, it's Major Howard, the Ox and Bucks, on Pegasus Bridge. And there's two bridges there. There's the lock... the bridge at Benneville and the bridge, because there's a canal and the Orne River. So they take both bridges. And the British airborne, the other objective of those airborne battalions is to destroy bridges over the Dives River, like where the Germans can possibly come down and counterattack that whole flank of the British sector from basically east of Caen. And so the British want to... The British don't just want that so that they can break out. They also want that because they don't want the Germans breaking into, like, Sword Beach, which is the... Sword Beach will be, if you're looking from the Allied point of view, from the water to the beach, it'll be the rightmost beach. That's where 3rd British Infantry Division lands. So the airborne guys get down. The Americans have... There's a lot of confusion going on in the American sector. That's going to last for... almost a full week of the battle where it's really chaotic. I'm not, to go into that would just take hours. The British pretty much get their objectives in the east with the airborne guys. So the air landing set. Now the Germans are starting to react to the landings. The commander of the 352nd Infantry Division actually sends a conf group, which is near Bayeux, which is between where the British and the Americans are land. He gets this early report of paratroop attack near Carentan, and he's worried that the Americans are going to seize that space between the where Utah and Omaha beaches, and that's actually a critical juncture. So he sends three battalions, the Fusilier Battalion and two battalions of, I can't remember what regiment, of the 350s. They start marching at 3 in the morning that way because the landings haven't occurred yet, so they don't know that they're going to be troops coming in at Omaha, Gold, Sword, and Juneau. So that's that German reaction. 21st Panzer Division, its divisional... By the way, the other thing that really messed up the Germans is that this is the one night where they chose to have a big army map exercise in Ron. This was Dolman, the 7th Army commander, you know, chose, because the weather was so bad, he said, well, this will be a good night to have a military, you know, exercise. So a lot of the German divisional commanders aren't in Normandy. The 91st Division commander, who else, the 243rd, these guys, they're not with their divisions. Now, the guy who's commanding the 21st Panzer Division, he was actually a political appointment. He was somebody, you know, one of Hitler's favorites. The guy, he was a mediocre to poor commander, actually, but they couldn't get rid of him. So they gave him a good chief of staff, and they made sure that the commanders underneath him were really good, like von Luck, who commands the 125th Panzer Grenadier Regiment. Opel Bronikowski commands the Panzer Regiment. And I forgot the name of the... Rouse commands the 192nd Panzer Grenadier Regiment. And these guys were... von Luck says, we were very fastidiously trained in anti-paratrooper operations. And their first instincts were to counterattack the paratroopers as soon as they landed. So that's what von Luck actually starts to try to do. He takes the 125th, and they're just outside of Caen. Now, the panzers are the two panzer battalions, one of which is just Sanhuas and has only half of it is panzer Mark IVs. They're still far back, so they have to be brought up before they can be used. But von Luck has Sturmgeschütz with him and stuff like that. So they start attacking the paratroopers. So, but the divisional commander is in Paris, and you read German accounts. The official German accounts are that he was there doing something with logistics, but he was actually there with his girlfriend. He was in a bordello, and he didn't even tell his divisional staff where he was, which is what you're supposed to. So they couldn't even get a hold of him. So for about 2 hours, the 21st Panzer Division, even though they're supposed to be attacking paratroopers right off the bat, they're kind of waiting for the divisional commander to say let's go. And finally, the Kampfgruppe commanders on their own decided to initiate the action. So that's what's happening then with the para guys. All right, then the next phase is the amphibious phase. So does anybody have any questions about the paratroop stuff at all?
You didn't mention, where's Rommel?
Oh, no, tell me.
Because that
I can't remember.
Rommel went back to his wife's birthday. He's not even in
Normandy. Oh, that's right. His wife's, because of the weather, he figures that they're not going to invade.
They're not going to go, right.
Right. By the way, an interesting little tidbit is, when Rommel is actually... wounded in that air attack, the village that's closest to him that he's wounded is Montgomery. That's the name of the French village that's closest to where his car is attacked is Montgomery. Let's talk about weird fate and stuff like that. So okay, so let's go to the landings. What time is it right now?
3:30.
So you got a half an hour left.
Oh, okay. I'm going to speed this up. All right, so there's Utah Beach, Omaha, Gold, Juneau, and Sword. And that's from west to east, starting the nearest to Cherbourg and the nearest to Caen. And on each beach, you pretty much have, except Omaha, you have about a divisional equivalent in the initial amphibious assault. At Utah Beach... they're actually lucky that they drift. The way the tides are running on Utah and Omaha, drift is from right to left of the ocean current. So they actually land about 2,000 meters, 2 kilometers further south than they were supposed to land. And that's actually turned out to be a good thing, because had they landed where they were supposed to, they would have encountered an additional strong point that was far stronger than the one they faced where they actually landed. Their beaches were Tar Beach and Uncle Beach were the code names for that. And initially, what they brought in is a battalion on each beach. They had the DD tanks come in. The surf there wasn't as bad as it is in Omaha. So they only lost, out of 32 tanks, four didn't make it in. Two foundered, and one hit a beach obstacle or something like that. So they got most of their armor ashore. And the whole idea with the DD tanks was, just before the infantry hits, we'll have these armored vehicles seemingly come right out of the ocean. And they'll be able to fire on the pillboxes and strong points. They'll also cover for the infantry that's coming in. And that works pretty much, everything works the way it's supposed to at Utah Beach. The DD tanks come in. The bombardment is fairly effective. There was a company of guys at a strong point about half a mile behind Utah Beach, and they're actually hit by an airstrike, and they're not killed or anything, but they're dazed. They're kind of like, they don't react because they've been scattered by the airstrike and they're kind of wandering around. So, Utah works really well. The tanks come ashore, the troops come ashore, there's no problem with the obstacles. There's intermittent artillery fire. They suffer about 190 casualties on that beach. There's a lot of German coastal artillery and coastal gun units, but those are all being tied up by the Navy. And when I talk about the game as an interesting thing, I've abstracted out the coastal artillery in the upcoming Atlantic Wall. I'll have an optional module for it, but the reason for that is with the naval gunfire and the coastal bombardment, they operate to cancel each other out. They both, in effect, have the effect they're supposed to. The naval gunfire, the German coastal artillery units, are just strong enough that the Navy has to commit enough power to silence them or keep them basically tied up. The Navy brings in enough naval gunpowder to do that. Now, they have surplus gunfire power, because it doesn't take all those ships to do that. So in the game, there'll be a table which you'll roll at the start of each turn, which will show you kind of approximate how much naval gunfire you'll actually still have left after you would have used dueling these coastal artillery units. A lot of these coastal artillery units, the heavy ones, weren't knocked out ever. They went out of commission until they either ran out of ammunition or they were overrun by advancing ground soldiers. Those are the ones like Longsumer, Kettleville, the Marcouf battery, which is like 280-millimeter guns. One gun got hit, knocked out by a lucky hit, but a lot of times what would happen is they'd man the guns, they'd fire some shells out at the ships would fire back, they might stun, they might get a couple of hits that stun the guys inside or something like that. The battery would silence for a couple of hours, then they would go back and operate. So it was like this day-long duel. But in effect, at the operational level, the coastal artillery, the artillery against the beaches was pretty minimal, the effect that it actually had, once the strong points were cleared out. And that's what happened in Utah. They had no more observers after about the second hour, so there was no one to watch the fall of the shell, so the artillery was ineffective. I'm going to skip Omaha right now and go to the British beaches. The British, because of their Dieppe experience, they had all those specialized army units. Because of the way the tides worked there and the way the beaches were, they actually landed an hour later than the Americans did. So they actually, the one thing they benefited from is the fact that all the British beaches got one extra hour of naval bombardment that the American beaches didn't get. Because the Americans landed at 6:30, the British came in at about 7 to 7:30. So there was an extra hour to pummel those strong points on the British beaches. Plus, the surf wasn't as bad as it was at Omaha. And initially, where it was a little tricky, the British LC-8, and those are the landing craft assault, LCT commanders, landing craft tank, made the decision to bring their tanks, in a lot of cases, just bring their tanks right in on the beach. Don't try to swim in. Because they saw that they launched a couple, and a couple of them sank right away. And they said, okay, forget this. Just bring them all in. We'll bring them in normally. What that meant, though, is that the fact, instead of the tanks coming up before the infantry, everybody just ends up landing on the beach about the same time. And this, by the way, I think it contributes to one of the conditions that the British didn't foresee and why they didn't get the Khan right away like they wanted to. They were landing. They landed so many vehicles on the beaches so quickly that the congestion, even when they cleared the beach, the congestion was just enormous. They were supposed to have a tank. In the British Army, a regiment is a battalion. I'll just use U.S. terms. They were supposed to have a tank battalion and an infantry battalion from the 185th Brigade near the near Sword Beach, head right for Khan right away. It took them hours just to get the tanks and everybody sorted out to get moving. So they almost lost like half a day just getting everybody organized to move. And part of the problem is because they had so many specialized armored tanks that was, coming in to help them with the assault. Now, with the British beaches, the good thing was these specialized tanks made breaches in the seawall and the pillbox line and everything pretty quickly, actually. And there was heavy fighting on two of them, on all the British beaches. There were sectors that was just as bad as Omaha, but it didn't last that long. The fact is that you in a couple of instances, several British companies were annihilated. They landed like 150 guys and like they had like 30 men left after an hour and a half. But they quickly broke through the initial obstacles and were able to get beyond the shingle and the seawall. And with all the specialized armor, they quickly knocked out a lot of those pillboxes that they needed to and cleared the beaches and were able to get off the beach. So the British beaches pretty much, go to plan. And so at Sword Beach, you had the 3rd British Division, which was Montgomery's old division in 1940. And they landed with a brigade up front and an armor brigade. On Juneau, it was the 3rd Canadian Division, landing with 2 brigades over 4 beaches. And on Gold, that was the 50th Division, landing with 2 brigades up front. And they actually attached the 56th Infantry Brigade to this division. So this division actually had 4 infantry brigades for the better part of D-Day and, D-Day to D-Day plus 3. And all these divisions had an attached armor brigade. So with the British beaches, there was initial fighting, some of it heavy, but they cleared the beaches pretty quickly and were able to start moving in. Now, the biggest problem is Omaha. And there's a lot of reasons why that's just turns into a debacle, initially. There's a really good book called Bloody Omaha, and it details the problems in planning for Omaha. And it's interesting because one of the things you get, if you really distill it down, and this is part of the problem with coalition warfare, is when the British and the Americans worked toward planning, and anything the Americans wanted to do at Omaha was directly affected by what the Brits were doing on the other beaches. Because there were a number of commanders, like Collins was brought in from the Pacific to command that corps that was landing in Omaha. He wanted to land in dark. He wanted to land 30 minutes before sunup. I mean, they knew what the Germans had at that beach. I mean, they had frogmen reconnaissancing it, the French resistance. They knew where the pillboxes were and everything, and they knew how strong it was. And Omaha was probably the closest thing to what the Germans would have considered ideal, with the exception of having tanks behind the beach. So if you want a test case of how the Germans, what the Germans thought should be optimal, Omaha was it. I mean, they thought, okay, we've got this beach covered. I mean, they're not going to be able to land here. Collins wanted to come in 30 minutes before sunup. Because he wanted surprise. And evolving from the Pacific Doctrine, there was this whole idea, and what the book talks about is if you're going to do an amphibious assault, there are two ways to do it. You either get tactical surprise, such that the defenders are surprised enough that you can take your objectives quickly, and usually that's like landing at night, so they can't see you, whatever. Or if you can't get surprised, you blast the hell out of it. And by blasting the hell out of it, and they learned this at Tarawa, it meant you don't just bombard the thing for, a day. You bombard the area for 3 or 4 days. You literally plastered the every square inch of the beach, you know, for days on end. Now, the British are saying, well, that's not realistic because you're going to be telling the Germans exactly where we're landing and they're going to move their tanks up. And so so there was this kind of compromise where they thought, okay, we'll do some bombardment, but we're not going to land. And the whole thing is landing at night, the tides affected that. The paratroopers said we needed moonlight so that it could only be certain days that they could land in June. And they looked at the tidal conditions, and well, if you're going to do that, you can only land on these days. Oh, and you want to land 30 minutes before sunup, but we want to land at low tide because we want the beach obstacles to be exposed because that's the only way our engineers can clear them. So the only time you can do that is on this day. Oh, but on this day, you can't land 30 minutes before dark if we're going to do this. So, but the weird thing is, out of all this planning, everybody kind of heard what they wanted to hear, each side. And basically, whereas the Germans had this inefficient compromise of where to put the panzers, you know, either behind the beach or far back from the beach, they kind of did both, which and then froze them there. For the Allies, Omaha, it was kind of the consequence of this because they didn't get the proper amount of bombardment that they should have had at Omaha. If they weren't going to come in with surprise, and they obviously didn't get surprise because they weren't landing at night. So the thing that they thought was going to make up for this was the Air Force, because they thought, okay, well, if we can't have this 3 or 4 day bombardment, let's just send in all these B-17s and B-25s and bomb the crap out of the beaches. The bombing will create shell holes on the beach for the infantry to shelter in. Will also knock out all the pillboxes and whatever. So all these planes, you know, they send this vast armada to arrive about, I think it's supposed to get there just as the sun is coming up, just before the waves hit, about 10 minutes before the assault waves are actually supposed to land. And they bomb the beaches, and not one bomb falls on anywhere on Omaha Beach. All the bombs fall, like, you know, the closest bomb is like a mile inland. And it shows you the limitations. And nobody quite understood the limitations of air power when it was applied to a ground situation. So these guys are starting to land, and they're realizing, and you read the accounts of these, first-hand accounts of these guys on Omaha Beach, and they say, we looked around, and there wasn't a single bomb crater anywhere. Because they're looking for, the first thing they're looking for is shell holes, because they realize, man, we're getting the shit shot out of us. You know, and they're, you know, the beach is flat, not one bomb hit. So that failed. All the LCT, they had these rocket ships off of Omaha, they all missed the beach. So no firepower hits the beach at Omaha. So all these strong points are intact. And the Germans are just sitting there waiting. And, you know, you've seen the movies and stuff. And it's the initial waves. For most of them, it's a slaughter. Now, a couple of companies or sections actually, man, because of the drift. By the way, in the 1st Infantry Division sector, which is where the 16th Infantry Regiment is landing, of the 32 DD tanks that are supposed to come in, there, it's almost like all but three sink. Okay, each battalion, tank battalion supporting each of the divisions landing in Omaha are supposed to come in with two companies each, with the DD tank system and another company in landing craft tank in the assault craft that carry tanks. The theory or the saying goes that they saw the tanks starting to sink as they were going off the ramps, you know, in the 1st Division sector. But the 1st Infantry Division had this can-do mentality. Some of them think they just kept going because they thought, we're the 1st Infantry Division. Fuck this, you know. Nothing's going to stop us. And they kept launching the tanks, and they kept sinking. So by the time they're done, they get about three tanks at the beach, and most of those, you know, get knocked out. And the only other tanks that come in there are the ones that are brought in by the landing craft. On the 29th sector, the first couple of tanks sink, and they decide right away, the guys there say, no, we're bringing them into the beach, just like the British. Just to jump ahead, one of the comments as far as the tanks go at Omaha is... one of the guys came in and said, well, let me sum up this. The tanks that did land got the crap shot out of them, But boy, they saved our asses. Because the tanks that survived, most of the tanks by the end of the day are knocked out, however they landed at Omaha. But they took on the strong points, the Vita Standest and the pillboxes point blank. And the infantry couldn't knock these strong points out until they got up to them. And getting up to them, we'll go into that story in a bit. So the tanks got the crap shot out of them, but they kept it from being a worse slaughter than it was in the 29th sector, because they actually helped tie up some of the pillboxes. All right, as far as landing, the whole plan is they're bringing in infantry, eight companies of infantry, four in each for each division, plus the Rangers, a company of Rangers on the far left, far right, which is the closest to point to home. Those guys are, they're pretty much all pinned down or shot up right away. And when you look at what's happening in Omaha, I mean, they were, unless the Germans brought in a lot more reinforcements or had panzers right behind the beach, my feeling is they were gonna succeed at Omaha eventually, because like one guy said, a lot of German machine guns by the afternoon were actually running out of ammo. They'd run out of ammo. And one guy fired off 12,000 rounds of machine gun stuff, but he couldn't get any resupply. And why that happened is, they just threw so much at the beach. They couldn't kill people fast enough initially, and they also fortified the areas of the draw at Omaha, because they figured that's where the Americans have to come up. And what makes Omaha really deadly is the one thing it has that the other beaches don't have, and it's shown in the games, they have the bluffs. And the Germans in those positions are anywhere from 100 to 150 feet above the beach. And, they have this incredible line of fire. And between the bluffs and the beach is what's called the pavilion, which is kind of like an open space. It'd be like where there's grass, the grass area between the beach and the sand dunes. And the Germans had heavily mined that. So there was that extra killing ground to get through. So that makes Omaha that much more tougher. But concomitantly, the one downfall of the Germans is because of these bluffs, there are also little ravines and like gullies between them. And eventually the infantry guys start to filter off the beach between the strong points and get up the bluffs in these, where they're covered by fire, because they can't actually be shot at because there's nobody covering a certain gully or ravine. So these small groups, by about 10:30 in the morning, there are people already getting up the bluffs, and by 11 o'clock, the Navy reports back to Bradley and finally says, "Well, we can see infantrymen and our guys up on the bluffs now." Up until about 10 o'clock or 10:30, Bradley was just he wasn't sure what was going to happen at Omaha. They actually thought they might actually have to evacuate the beach and give it up. And it's interesting because the German commander actually thought Omaha was well taken care of up to about 9 a.m. Because and his name is Kreiss, K-R-A-I-S-S. And he gets a phone call from the overall commander of the Omaha Beach Sector, and he says, "Well, how are things going?" And he says, "Oh, it's fine. All the tanks are burning, their landing craft are foundering. We're winning. We're defeating them." So he thinks, "Oh, everything's okay at Omaha." So that comp troop that he originally sent against the paratroopers, they were at Bayou. He sends them against the so-called paratroop landing near Isigny. When the landings start, he starts to send them back. He gets the call from the guy in Omaha saying, "Well, we got this under control." So he basically says, he is getting no communication from the Germans at the British beaches, especially Gold Beach, which is in his sector for the 352nd, part of it. He's working the 716th. So he sends them to Gold Beach. So here's three battalions that he actually could have diverted to Omaha Beach. They probably could have gotten there at 1 in the afternoon. They wouldn't have stopped the Americans, but they would have kept the I think they would have penned them in even more heavily further than they did. So, what they eventually do commit to Omaha is part of a pioneer, the engineer battalion for the 352nd Division. They send some Martyrs anti-tank guns at 10 o'clock to Omaha, but it takes them 3 hours to get to even get to near Saint Laurent, and they don't even get there because a fighter bomber aircraft basically intercept them and knock out like half the tanks right there. So, but one thing that kind of the thing that saves the day at Omaha or makes them able to actually get through is the destroyer gunfire support. The Navy essentially starts to move its destroyers in to like within a quarter mile of the beach. I mean, the Army guys are coming. They said it looked like the Navy guys were trying to land their destroyers. You know, and the destroyers took on these pillboxes with that point blank range, you know, with the 5-inch guns. The other thing that saved in the 29th sector is two companies of Rangers. In Saving Private Ryan, he's C Company, and C Company and A Company come in the first hour, and you know you see what happens to them in the movies. Five other Ranger companies, though, come in an hour after them, and the Ranger Battalion Group Commander, it's supposed to be the 2nd and the 5th Ranger Battalions, he sees what's happening on the beach, and after about 8 o'clock, everyone sees what's going on the beach in the 29th sector, and they say, you know, don't land there. So he actually says, we're not landing, we're supposed to. He redirects them, and he can see that the best place to land is between the draws, because he sees Americans going up the bluff. So he lands these Ranger companies to the left of where they're supposed to land by about a kilometer. And, you know, the effect of them was pretty dramatic, because all of a sudden, you had about 400 or 500 more elite trained infantrymen getting over the seawall and getting up the bluffs, and they were able to move quickly, and they were very well motivated. And they get up the draws along with a few infantrymen that make it, and they start to take the strong points on from the side. By the way, once you get infantrymen up there, the strong points aren't sighted to fire laterally. They're sighted to fire on the beach. And sometimes they have some mutual support, but they're not very, you know, obviously not very effective if you take them from behind, and they can't really control the area. The whole idea was that the strong points would stop the Americans just long enough so that the actual reserves could come up and then occupy the rest of the beach and knock the Americans back into the sea. But since when no reserves came up, eventually there was going to be, you know, leakage through the areas that were covered, and then the Americans started to take the strong points from the side. So, you know, you had the Rangers really... That was a really big, important force that came in that helped them out quite a bit. So...
You have 5 minutes.
Yeah. Anyway, that takes us... I mean, that's kind of... You know, and Omaha is obviously, of all the beaches, it has the narrowest area and depth of penetration of all the beaches. There are actually some German... There's like elements of a German company still in one of the towns... That's just like a mile from the beach. That they're still there till June 7th, the middle of the next day. They never even actually don't get cleared out. But of course, Americans are just happy to have actually got to Omaha and actually have held on. Another thing that's interesting too is in the 29th Division Sector, after 10 a.m. in the morning, it was so bad there that they literally closed that beach for anybody else landing. So after those Rangers came in, the five Ranger companies, nobody else landed in the 29th Infantry Division sector for the rest of the day. Everyone else was sent into where the 1st Infantry was coming in. So that's kind of hairy because the guys that were already there had to hang on for the rest of the day into the evening, you know. And if they had not been able to hang on, then they would have been able to clear Omaha Beach. I mean, if the Germans had been able to get people there, it could have been bad. I left out the Rangers at Point du Hoc. The Rangers sent two companies there because they originally thought there was a big battery of 155 guns that could fire in Omaha Beach at Point du Hoc. So they land, but they actually lose one of their boats coming in, so they don't have everybody, they don't even have two full companies, and the other boat gets scattered. They climb the cliffs like you've seen in the movie. They go straight up the cliffs and take on the German strong point and get to the bunker and find out that the guns have been moved. And, you know, in the longest day, okay, end of story, but in point of fact, those two, there was about 60 guys left, and they had to hold on for the next day and a half by themselves because nobody got to them. And the Germans counterattacked them a number of times trying to wipe them out. And they were pretty much on their last legs by the time that the reinforcements finally got to them. And those five Ranger companies, their job was to link up with those guys, but the resistance between them and where the Rangers were at Omaha was so stiff that it took them a day and a half before they could get there. And that was a pretty touch-and-go thing. Well, the British used Rangers. They called them Commandos, the Special Service Brigade. Those in the movie Longest Day, you see there are two troops of them that go and take the battery out at Wiestrom, and they're supposed to link up with the paratroop guys with the 6th Airborne and also link up the beaches. They pretty much accomplished the beach link up eventually, and then those commandos were supposed to be pulled out after about the first week, but the two Special Service Commando Brigades for the Brits end up holding the bridgehead with the 6th Airborne until August. So, you know, which is totally crazy because you should never use elite troops like they're using them as infantry. In the game terms, it'd be like two medium strength battalions of infantry with really high morale, you know, in terms of a game if you're fighting at battalion level. So that's pretty much up to date, and then from there on, you know, you have the Normandy campaign, but a lot of how that campaign develops is really influenced by what happened around Caen on June 6th, because had the British taken Caen like they wanted to on June 6th, you probably would have had a campaign that evolved the way the Allies thought, which was that on D plus 90, they'd be at the Seine River, and the Germans would be holding from the mouth of Seine to Paris, but the German army, you know, would be more of a coherent force, wouldn't be disintegrating. As it was, all the fighting was actually maintained in the Normandy campaign for the next 2.5 months. And the Allies didn't get anywhere. And by the way, the other reason they really wanted Caen was that whole area around it was suitable for airfield construction. And the 2nd Tactical Air Force, which was the guys supporting the Commonwealth armies, that was their big goal. It says, get us those airfields. And they were really pissed off at that Monty because they had been planning to get those airfields after the first week, and they don't fall. Caen doesn't fall until like basically the middle of... Well, Caen itself falls around July 8th or 9th, but the area for those airfields doesn't effectively fall until after July 24th. So that was a big problem for the air guys. And that's another reason why Monty may have launched Goodwood too, because he was getting pressure to take that area around Caen so they could develop the air power infrastructure they needed. All right.
Two questions.
Sure.
Utah, light casualties, Omaha, really heavy. We know that.
Yeah.
But what I was surprised about is when I read about the Canadian Division, the 3rd Canadians, they suffered 50% casualties on that first day.
Yeah, it was heavy fighting.
I mean, you don't think about that because Omaha has always been the one, the bloody Omaha and everything, but the Canadians just get the crap shot out of them on the other beach.
Yeah.
It shows how devastating the other beaches were also
to
the invading forces. Utah was the only one that truly get off
light. Yeah, Utah was a cakewalk compared to all the other beaches. But in every other beach, there are places you could find that were easily as intense as Omaha. But like I said, with the British beaches, it didn't last as long. I mean, basically, for the most part, by the time you get to about 12 o'clock, 1 p.m. in the afternoon, most of the British beaches by then are operational. They're not under that kind of fire. They've taken most of the strong points. But so for the first 3 or 4 hours, it could be pretty very heavy, especially like you said, at Juneau and stuff.
Okay, and the second thing is in the game.
Yeah.
Do you allow for any alternatives, or are you forced to invade exactly in those beaches that were set up? You're just simply going to implement the plan. You're not going to alter the plan. Is that what's going on here?
You're not going to change any of the other beaches, because when you really look at it, those are the beaches you'd have to land at. I mean, you know, if you guys want to come over here, I can, if you have time, I'll talk about the game now. We'll kind of see what other people are talking about.
This is cool.
This is generally 1 mile.
When did the game first come out? The original game. When did that come out?
It was 1977.
1977. Okay.
That was horrible.
Yeah, it was. I mean, you know, there was really. notes or anything, and the lead gunfire was just like... Okay, I'll show you the beaches first. In the game, all the beaches are actually a separate game, and in the game, the beaches are solitaire. There's no point in having a German player play the beaches, because all the Germans are doing is just shooting. That's a pretty boring thing. So what happens is, you know, you have a sea box, a beach box, a shingle box, coastal defense box, and exit box. Now, Omaha is different. And here, you move just like on a checkerboard. You know, you basically, you can move one, infantry can generally move one or two boxes, diagonal cost two, whatever. And you'll land, and as you put guys into each sector, you'll roll a dice, generate the fire value against a box, and this will tell you what step losses or pins you get. You don't get to choose how you inflict the losses on your guys in this.
Yeah, I want to real rush you, like 5 minutes ago, we were supposed to start another seminar.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. You guys interested in hearing about this a little more?
Sure. We could take it. And is the table free at the end of the hall?
Although, how many of you guys probably want to hear Frank, though, too, right?
Right.